Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
The Constitution says it plainly. Congress decides when the United States goes to war. The last formal war declaration from Congress? 1942. But since then, the legislative branch has issued several authorizations for the use of military force, or AUMFs. But sometimes, presidents haven't even waited for congressional blessing before deploying the might of the U.S. military. In 1970, during the Vietnam War, President Nixon did not tell Congress or the country that he'd launched a bombing campaign in Cambodia until 2 days later.
In cooperation with the armed forces of South Vietnam, attacks are being launched this week to clean out major enemy sanctuaries on the Cambodian-Vietnam border.
That was the last straw for a country mired in an unpopular war. In November 1973, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution, with a bipartisan majority, mind you. The act required applying the, quote, collective judgment of both the Congress and the president when entering hostilities, and requires the president to consult with Congress before military actions and, importantly, consult regularly with Congress so long as the military is engaged in those hostilities. The next president, Gerald Ford, chafed at the new law.
I firmly believe that trying to put on paper a precise procedure by which things have to be done in a crisis is impractical in the first place.
And yet, the War Powers Resolution did not impede presidents from deploying the U.S. military to Lebanon, 1982, Grenada, 1983, Panama, 1989, the Persian Gulf, 1990, Somalia, 1992. Now, in most of those cases, Congress provided some form of blessing, even if sometimes after the fact of the military operation. Then comes 1994. President Clinton threatens to invade Haiti. Then Senator Joe Biden, in a speech on the Senate floor, pushes back, saying that except in rare circumstances, a president must get permission from Congress first.
Until authority is granted, the president has no inherent power to send forces to war, except, as I said, in certain very limited circumstances, such as to repel sudden attacks or to protect the safety and security of Americans abroad.
But that was then.
He's been president for less than a month, or just over a month, I should say, and Joe Biden has now ordered his first military strike of his presidency. The targets were Iranian-backed Iraqi militia based in eastern Syria, just across the Iraqi border.
Now, President Biden did not ask Congress for permission when he ordered airstrikes in Syria on February 25th. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. War, hostilities, military action, call it what you want. Presidents have found little to no resistance from Congress almost every single time they've wanted to deploy the U.S. military. Note the authorization Congress issued for the 2001 war in Afghanistan and in 2002 for the Iraq war. Presidents Bush, Obama, and Trump all cited those AUMFs as justification for military strikes in the regions years later. Well, now, there's a growing movement on Capitol Hill to reassert legislative authority and the War Powers Act. So what are the advantages and the potential disadvantages to reining in a president's power to wage war? That's what we're going to talk about today. And joining us to do so is Congressman Jim McGovern, Democratic Congressman from Massachusetts and chair of the House Rules Committee. The Rules Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee both held hearings last week on reforming and reclaiming the War Powers Resolution. Congressman McGovern, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be with you.
Also with us today is Congressman Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma. He is the ranking member of the same committee. He joins us from Moore, Oklahoma. Congressman Cole, welcome to you as well.
It's great to be with you.
So, Representative McGovern, actually, I'm going to start with a question directly to both of you. What is it that the two of you agree on right now about needed changes to the War Powers Resolution, and why now?
Well, I think we both agree that the War Powers Resolution needs to be modernized and reformed. It's too easy for presidents of either party to get us involved in wars, and it's too easy for presidents to ignore Congress. And unfortunately, over the years, Congress has been too willing to allow the president to basically take away its power. Look, war is a big deal. People die in war. We've lost constituents in wars. We ought to debate these wars. We ought to analyze whether it's the right thing to do or not. And Congress ought to go on record as voting yes or no. But we ought not to, you know, cede that constitutional responsibility to an executive branch because, one, it's not in keeping with the spirit of the Constitution or what's written in the Constitution. And two, you know, it's a betrayal of our constituents to not do due diligence when it comes to going to war.
Congressman Cole, go ahead.
Well, I certainly agree with everything that Chairman McGovern had to say. Frankly, he's been a leader in this effort for a number of years, and I think it's important to point out he's been a leader whether there was a Democratic or a Republican president. He's been very consistent in his views. But we certainly have gone to war. I think of the Obama administration in two instances where we never voted, and I favored one, opposed the other. I favored the president's actions against ISIS. Would have been happy to support that, and that continued into the Trump administration. It worked successfully in terms of ending the physical caliphate. I think it would have had broad congressional support. I opposed his efforts in Libya, where he stretched the NATO alliance, I think, beyond the breaking point, using that as the justification. Again, never a real congressional vote authorizing sustained military action in Libya. So, again, there's a lot of common ground between Jim and myself. And I think that reflects common ground between both parties, a real desire to reassert and preserve congressional war-making authority.
Yeah, so Congressman McGovern, picking up on what Congressman Cole just said there, is the primary problem in circumstances where Congress, there was never a congressional vote, the sheer fact that Congress never took it up? I mean, I'm not – explain to me what aspect of the War Powers Act precludes Congress from saying, actually, no, wait, we're going to take a vote first, Mr. President, prior to you deploying the troops.
Well, I mean, oftentimes the president deploys the troops before even, you know, asking for Congress, informing Congress. Look, you know, one of the things that, you know, that really is troubling to both of us is the fact that again, it is we've passed what you referred to at the beginning of your program, these authorizations for the use of military force, AUMFs, and you know, and they never end, and they're used to justify military action years later. I mean, the 2001 and 2002 AUMFs dealing with Afghanistan and Iraq are still used today, over 20 years later, to justify military action in various places. That's crazy. I mean, back 20 years ago, nobody had any clue what the realities of 2021 would be. The 1991 authorization for the use of military force in Kuwait under the first President Bush, that's still on the books. So what has happened is that these AUMFs that never end are then used for presidents to justify various action around the world. That's just crazy.
Well, point taken. But again, when we're talking about Congress reasserting its authority, Representative McGovern, why vote for an open-ended AUMF? Why aren't more members of Congress saying no?
Well, we shouldn't. And, you know, one of the things we should do is we should repeal the 2001 and 2002 AUMF and the 1991 AUMF. And in the future, if Congress votes on AUMFs, in my opinion, there ought to be sunsets at the minimum. I mean, these should not be allowed to go on forever and ever. You know, presidents are in power for 4 or 8 years. AUMFs that were passed under their administrations shouldn't last, you know, well into, you know, several administrations later. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just can't be right.
Well, Representative Cole, I know I've only got you for a couple of more minutes here, so let me ask you some questions here. What would you like to see changed in the War Powers Resolution specifically?
Well, let's start where Chairman McGovern mentioned and clean up some of the stuff that needs to be repealed. I would repeal the 1991 and the 2002 AUMFs. I think the 2001, which is the response to 9/11 and gives us broad authority to strike a transnational terrorist group needs to be modified, but probably needs to be kept in some form. I probably a decade ago would have opposed the sunset provisions. I'm coming around to Jim's thinking on that, quite frankly. I think there's got to be some way where Congress renews these things, because otherwise, again, they just go on interminably, and we're never confronted with that. And frankly, leadership in both parties tends to want to spare their members tough votes, particularly when the presidency happens to lie within the same party that controls the Congress. So we need to not shield members from tough votes. We need to have mechanisms that force them to take tough votes and then go home and justify their position. So those are all things I think there's a lot of common ground on in the body. And again, the idea that if we're going to do something as extensive as Libya was or dismantling ISIS was, that's going to require something that's new. There's nothing in the 2001 or 2 AUMF that authorizes us, for instance, to go into Syria, a sovereign country, and be engaged in hostilities inside of Syria. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah. To that point, actually, the February 25th strike that President Biden authorized inside of Syria 2 days later, when he had to submit his report to Congress on the 27th, in fact, he didn't even reference any existing AUMF as justification for the strike. He just referenced his authority as Commander-in-Chief of the United States military in an effect.
I would actually agree with the president on it. He referenced his Article II powers, which I actually think was the right thing to do. And this was a one-off strike. It wasn't engaged. We were responding to an attack. I think that's well within a president's authority. If you attack American forces or American contractors, this was designed to retaliate and send a message, and there was no further action after that. So I think you have to leave the executive that kind of flexibility. That's a lot different than engaging in a many-month air campaign in Libya or, again, an effort in both Iraq and Syria to dismantle ISIS and where you put troops on the ground in addition to using air power. So, it's difficult sometimes to get the exact definition, but a one-off strike in retaliation seems to me to be well within the president's powers.
Well, Tom Cole, Republican congressman from Oklahoma and ranking member on the House Rules Committee. Congressman Cole, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
And Congressman McGovern, stand by for just a second. We got to take a quick one-minute break. We'll be right back. We're talking about rethinking the War Powers Resolution and Congress seeking to reassert itself when it comes to deploying the U.S. military. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we are talking about renewed energy on Capitol Hill to rethink the War Powers Resolution, or at least to have Congress reassert its authority over when presidents go to war. I'm joined today by Jim McGovern. He's Democratic Congressman from Massachusetts, chair of the House Rules Committee. The committee held a hearing just last week on reforming the War Powers Resolution. And Congressman McGovern, I did want to ask you what you thought about that last question that I turned to Representative Cole about the fact that President Biden did not reference any existing AUMF for the justification for his February 25th strike. Now, Congressman Cole said he thought that was just fine, one-off. It does fall within the powers of the president as commander-in-chief. I wonder if you agree or disagree with him.
Well, I respectfully disagree. I mean, I was concerned about that action and the lack of notification with Congress. I worry about the slippery slope. And so, again, I believe that we need to kind of clarify the rules of engagement beforehand. What we see oftentimes is the president strike first and inform Congress later. Mm-hmm. And often we don't even know the president's intent ahead of time, so it's impossible even to vote for us. So that's why I think we need to change the law as it exists today. And we need to make it clear to whoever is in the White House that, look, Congress is not a potted plant here. The Constitution envisions a major role for us here. And on issues of war, it's a big deal, and we ought to take the time, and we ought to be involved.
Right. You know, and looking back at history, there have been times where, to your point, presidents didn't turn to Congress first. I'm remembering Panama, right? 1989, yep. December 20th, President George H.W. Bush deploys 14,000 members of the U.S. military to Panama to oust Manuel Noriega. Pulls them out by, if I'm remembering correctly, February of 1990. That happened to fall in between Congresses, too. So Congress never acted on that. So specifically, though, then, you talked about sunset provisions.
Right.
What else would you do to change – are we talking about changing the War Powers Resolution specifically here?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes. And then I would also say that we should require consultation with Congress, not just passive notification, as we've been seeing. We should require contemporaneous notification at a minimum in emergency situations, improve the reporting requirements. We ought to be talking about automatic appropriations turnoff, while ensuring safe withdrawal of our service members. And again, there ought to be prior approval for military action to the extent that that is possible. And I have watched how presidents, both Democrats and Republicans, over the years have basically kind of ignored the congressional role. And sometimes their military actions have, worked out fine. Sometimes they haven't. But the bottom line is that's not the way it's supposed to work. And we in Congress, I mean, we're elected to basically be a check, to do our job, to do the necessary oversight, to make sure that whatever a president is doing is in the best interest of our country. I mean, as I said, war is a big deal. People die in wars. And we have entered into military conflicts over and over again in a very casual way. And even this war in Afghanistan, I mean, again, it's been going on since 2001. I mean, the mission today is so different than it was when we first got involved in this war. And yet Congress has done little to do oversight, to do the necessary checks and balances, to even, critically assess whether this is a good mission or not. And yet we commit American troops. Their lives are in danger. People die. It is costing our treasury trillions of dollars. I mean, we have people critical of the money we spent on the American Rescue Plan to help people get through this pandemic. We've spent more than that on the war in Afghanistan. And there's very little debate about that.
Mm-hmm. And the next war after that in Iraq, just for the record, you voted against that AUMF.
I did. Yeah.
So I just wanted to ask you, though, do you see any potential downsides here? I mean, you talked about emergency authorization. It would seem that some of the types of military action that the presidents have chosen to take in recent years required very fast response. Is there a potential of sort of hampering the U.S. military if Congress is going to need to be involved repeatedly?
No, okay. There isn't. And I think we can work this out in a way to accommodate all situations that may arise. You know, one of the pushbacks that we have received, on this has been, we're insulting or somehow offending our troops when we talk about debates on wars, especially in the aftermath of having them being committed to some place in the world. The contrary is true. I mean, I was in Afghanistan a few years ago, and I visited some of the Massachusetts troops. I remember one guy came up to me and said, do you people in Congress even know what the hell's going on here? Do you have any idea what we're doing? I don't even know what we're doing here anymore. Can someone explain that to me? He says, this is a terrible waste of life. It's a terrible waste of taxpayer dollars. We got to get the hell out of here. But the point of the matter is that, you know, we're not honoring his service or the service of the men and women in places like Afghanistan if we allow these wars to go on automatic pilot. And again, AUMFs, you know, at a minimum ought to be sunsetted so that Congress is forced to debate and to vote on these things. And Tom Cole, you know, said it correctly. Members of Congress sometimes like to avoid tough votes. You know, voting on wars is a tough vote. But that's what we're elected to do. And we ought to live up to our constitutional responsibility. We ought to honor our men and women in the armed forces to make sure that we're not committing them, you know, to conflicts that, quite frankly, are not in the national interest of our country. And so, you know, debate, checks and balances, consultation, votes, those are all things that we should all embrace, no matter what our political party may be.
Well, so let's just pursue this for a little further, because Congressman McGovern, I do wonder if you think that the toughest hill you're going to have to climb is with your fellow members of Congress. I mean, let's just give an example here. I think it was in the Obama administration that at least at one point in time, President Obama had talked about his interest in refining the 2001 AUMF. I think it was roughly 2015 he started saying that, but that just never happened. Congress never took that question up. As you pointed out earlier, just continued to send funding for counterterrorism operations, even as the mission in Afghanistan had changed so radically. And, I mean, it is true. Members of Congress don't want to take tough votes. No one wants to be seen, except in the rarest of circumstances, as voting against the United States military. Do you think whatever energy there is right now about rethinking the War Powers Resolution is just going to fizzle when your fellow representatives and senators realize that, oh, this might mean we're going to have to go on the record a lot more often about the use of the U.S. military?
Well, look, I think Congress's inability to tackle this question and their continued insistence on trying to avoid voting on wars is tantamount to moral cowardice. That's the only way I can describe it. And I said in the hearing in the Rules Committee that we may have finally captured lightning in the bottle. We have people like the President, President Biden, who has a history of raising, I think, legitimate questions with regard to the need to reform the War Powers Resolution and talking about the need to rein in presidential authority. Tom Cole, my colleague from Oklahoma, Republican, a conservative Republican, you know, is coming to the understanding that we need to do something. There are Democrats and Republicans in the House and in the Senate who are now beginning to talk more and more about the need to do something here. So this may be a unique opportunity where we can reform and modernize the War Powers Resolution in a way that, is not only is in the best interest of our troops so we don't commit them to unnecessary wars, but is in the best national security interest of the United States. Because we don't want to be involved in wars that have no end. We don't want to be involved in wars that result in the loss of life, not just our troops, but the lives of innocent lives in these other countries, and wars that, quite frankly, bankrupt our treasury. So this, to me, is the right time to be talking about these things, and the stars may be aligning.
Well, Congressman McGovern, I would love to have you back as Congress gets closer to perhaps actually doing something when the rubber meets the road. If we could, I'd love to have you back then.
Well, Megha, thank you. I appreciate it, and I look forward to it.
Well, that's Jim McGovern. He's Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, chair of the House Rules Committee, which just had a hearing last week on reforming the War Powers Resolution. And folks, if you've got some thoughts about changing or Congress reasserting its authority over deployment of the U.S. military, hop over on Facebook or Twitter and send us your thoughts. We're at On Point Radio. Now, let's listen. We've talked about these AUMFs, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, from 2001 regarding Afghanistan and 2002 regarding Iraq. They come up over and over again because a lot of analysts, and you heard Jim McGovern even say this, they believe that those two original AUMFs have been basically, in the words of one analyst, Stephen Walt, stretched beyond recognition. Well, how did that happen? John Yoo was Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legal Counsel under President Bush. In 2002, he drafted the so-called torture memos that justified waterboarding and other harsh interrogation methods in the early days of the War on Terror. John Yoo also drafted the 2001 and 2002 authorizations for the use of military force, or those AUMFs. So we reached out to John Yoo, and he told us about how he crafted the 2001 authorization in the days right after 9/11.
One of the things we tried to do on purpose when we drafted this was to make sure that it was not limited to any specific region or geography. You'll notice the AUMF of 2001 doesn't mention any country, doesn't mention any specific region. It's not just linked to the groups that carried out 9/11, but any groups that supported them or the groups that they became. And then the third one you'll notice, and this is what's most controversial now, is that we didn't have a time limit or a sunset provision, as it's called in Congress, on it, because we didn't know on September 11th or September 18th, 2001, what the fight against terrorism would look like 3 years, 5 years, 10 years later, because we'd never fought such a fight. So we drafted it to be as open-ended, as flexible as possible.
Now, again, John Yoo was a member of the Office of Legal Counsel for the White House. He drafts the AUMF. A few days later, Congress passed it into law. That AUMF was used 10 years later in the 2011 drone assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki, a key al-Qaeda figure and an American citizen.
Our intelligence had located him in a car traveling with a number of other people in the deserts of Yemen. We felt that striking al-Awlaki would fall within the AUMF, even though he was an American citizen, even though he was outside where all the attention was at the time, which was Afghanistan. And even though we couldn't say he had actually himself been part of the planning of the 9/11 attacks.
So that's an example of the stretching of the 2001 authorization that initially was passed by Congress regarding Afghanistan. Now, John Yoo also helped draft the 2002 authorization for the use of military force to justify the invasion of Iraq. And he told us about going to Capitol Hill to explain the bill to a prominent senator.
And I thought this was strange. Like, they're the ones in charge of drafting and writing it. Why am I, a member of the executive branch, going to see a senator tell them what their own bill means? That's not the way it's supposed to work. So I go in. And I won't say which senator this is, although he was a very prominent senator involved with foreign relations at the time. He's no longer there. And I remember one of the first things he says is, why are you making us vote on this? And I said, what do you mean, Senator? We're not making you vote on anything. It's up to you whether to take up any vote. But he says, I don't want to vote on this. Most of my colleagues don't want to vote on this. Don't make us vote on this. Members of Congress, they don't want to vote on AUMFs unless they're easy, unless it's going to be they'd rather have the president take the responsibility and the accountability because wars are unpredictable.
Now, John Yoo still believes that the breadth and vagueness of the 2001 AUMF is justified. However, he told us he's surprised that it remains on the books to this day and that presidents of both parties have stretched it beyond recognition.
I didn't think it would go on for 20 years. 20 years surprises me. And I didn't think at the time that it would involve this would be the use of it to justify attacks on other sovereign nations. So you could say, well, the AUMF of 2001, if it's used to justify the strike against Syrian chemical plants, that might be a stretch.
John Yoo, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel under President George W. Bush, now a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. Well, let's turn now to Ona Hathaway, professor of international law at Yale. She testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee last week on that hearing about reclaiming the War Powers Act. Professor Hathaway, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Matthew Waxman, professor of law at Columbia. He served at the State Department, the Department of Defense, and the National Security Council in the administration of George W. Bush. Professor Waxman, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me as well.
Okay, so Professor Hathaway, let me start with you. What's your response to John Yoo's surprise that the AUMF that he helped draft, deliberately vague with no specific nation in the actual text of the draft, is still being used 20 years later?
Yeah, it is a bit surprising. I don't think anyone anticipated that in 2001. They were acting, remember, just days after the 9/11 attacks. The authorization was passed on September 18. So we're talking just a few days after the attacks. Part of the reason for the vagueness was we didn't know for sure who had carried out the attacks. We had some suspicions, we had some intelligence, but there was still a lot of uncertainty. And so part of the reason for drafting it as broadly and vaguely as it was drafted was to give the president some flexibility. I don't think anyone who voted on that resolution, though, anticipated we'd be using it 20 years later for war across the Middle East. So he's right about that.
Matthew Waxman, we've just got about 30 seconds before the first break. Do you share that surprise? I mean, as a U.S. citizen now with the benefit of hindsight, I'm not sure I'm surprised at all. Like, you give authorization to use power, people will use that power.
Yeah, it was passed almost immediately after the 9/11 attacks with, I think, minimal deliberation. The executive branch wanted something very broad. Congress wanted to express its support and didn't push back when it started being used very expansively.
Well, Matthew Waxman and Ona Hathaway, stand by for a moment, because when we come back, I want to hear from both of you about really where does the responsibility lie and what needs to be changed if there is indeed this growing agreement that perhaps presidents might need to be reined in or Congress needs to assert its authority more. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Wednesday on the show, we're going to take a look at the bevy of bills in states across this country dealing with voting. And so we want to hear from you about that after the 2020 election. What regulations do you think are necessary, if at all, for safe, fair voting access? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today on the show, we're talking about energy on Capitol Hill to take another look at the War Powers Act, or that half-century-old act that requires that presidents consult with Congress before using the United States military abroad. I'm joined today by Ona Hathaway. She's a professor of international law at Yale. She testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee last week on a hearing on reclaiming congressional war powers. Matthew Waxman is with us as well, professor of law at Columbia, served in the George W. Bush administration, including at the NSC. He was involved in the White House response to the attacks of September 11th, 2001. And Professor Waxman, let's talk a little bit more about that 2001 AUMF, because I think it's possibly the marquee example, right? And so if I understand correctly, you were at the White House on the day of 9/11. Can you tell us a little bit more about sort of how that AUMF came together and did it receive at all adequate congressional scrutiny?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was at the White House on 9/11, and one of the things that's remarkable about the 2001 AUMF is just how quickly it was passed. I mean, this was drafted literally while, you know, the Pentagon is still smoldering, the Capitol is essentially in lockdown, and not only did, as John Yoo say, the executive branch want something broad, but Congress really wanted to sort of get in the game and express its support. I think, as Ona says, it was not really clear at that point exactly what the military campaign of response to the 9/11 attacks was going to look like. So there was a need to build in a lot of flexibility. I think there were some elements of a response that were clear pretty quickly, but it wasn't really clear how a conflict with a transnational terrorist organization was going to go. And so the language was indeed written very, very broadly. I'm among those who's surprised that, you know, 20 years later, we're still operating under the same language. But I think part of the problem has been that even if there's a high degree of consensus that the law is in need of reform, there's not consensus about how to reform it, mm-hmm. what a better one would look like.
Okay, so Professor Hathaway, let's talk about that, because it does sound like, at least specifically regarding this 2001 AUMF, there is, as Matthew Waxman points out, emerging consensus that some kind of repeal replace needs to happen. So regarding that replacement, what should it have in it that the current AUMF does not have?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Matt is right, that there is a consensus that the 2001 AUMF is really outdated, and the devil's in the details of what the replacement will look like. And what I'm struck by is that there seems to be greater consensus on that than I've ever seen. So you heard that in the first half of the show, you know, two members of Congress from different parties both agreeing that there should be a reauthorization requirement, or sometimes called a sunset. That is relatively new, that there's agreement on both sides of the aisle that if we put in place a new AUMF, it shouldn't last forever and ever, that there should be some requirement that at some point Congress has to come back and vote again if it wants to continue it. Now, there may be some disagreement about how long that should be. Should it be 2 years? Should it be 3 years? Should it be 4 years? But there's general agreement that we shouldn't be passing AUMFs that last forever and ever and ever. And so if there's a new replacement AUMF, it should have, and I think it will have, a reauthorization requirement.
Okay, so that's one way to narrow its scope. Also, the original one was totally open-ended in terms of who the actual enemy was. Would you like to see sort of greater specificity on that?
Absolutely. So, you know, for good reason, you know, we're less than a week, or just about a week out from the 9/11 attacks. The 2001 AUMF didn't specifically define the enemy, although honestly it defined it more narrowly than it's sometimes given credit for. But a new AUMF should define the enemy. It should be much clearer about who it is Congress wants to allow the president to use military force against. It should list the groups, and it should be very specific about how far the authority extends and what the limits of that authority would be.
Hmm. Well, let's listen, since this is Afghanistan specific, let's listen to a moment where, as candidate, President Biden said it was well past time, I guess I should say then candidate Biden, said it was well past time to end the forever wars. And according to a deal struck between the Trump administration and the Taliban, the U.S. in fact faces a May 1st deadline to get troops out of Afghanistan. And at his first press conference just last week, President Biden was asked about that deadline.
Can you commit to the American people that by May 2nd, the U.S. will no longer have forces in Afghanistan?
The answer is that it's going to be hard to meet the May 1 deadline. Just in terms of tactical reasons, it's hard to get those troops out. So what we've been doing, what I've been doing, and what Secretary Blinken has been doing has been, we've been meeting with our allies, those other nations that have NATO allies who have troops in Afghanistan as well, and And if we leave, we're going to do so in a safe and orderly way.
So Matthew Waxman, I think it was just, a couple of weeks ago that President Biden, the administration actually announced that it wants to work with Congress to repeal the two AUMFs we've been talking about, 2001 and 2002, and replace them, as we've been talking, with a narrow and specific framework. Essentially, that would rein in ostensibly President Biden's own abilities to use those AUMFs in the region moving forward. Do you think he's sincere in that desire?
I think he's probably sincere. I think the Obama administration was also sincere. But in order to get it done, it's probably going to take more than just a statement from the podium saying this is something I'd like to do. I think the real question is whether the White House is actually willing to spend some political capital on the issue. And, you know, it's going to take, I think, a lot of concerted effort from both political branches to get it done. I think the issue of Afghanistan and the so-called forever war, though, there also raises another issue, which I think is sometimes overlooked here, which is that for all of the attention on Congress's authority, Congress's power to initiate war, to get involved in decisions to start wars, I'd rather see Congress devoting a lot more attention to overseeing how wars are conducted. And I think sometimes the attention to which branch of government has control over war initiation tends to obscure that very important role where I think Congress very much needs to up its game.
But how wars are conducted, meaning what, though?
Meaning how well, whether the United States' means and ends are well matched. You know, we've been engaged in a war in Afghanistan for two decades now. And, you know, I'm dispirited, for example, by the lack of hearings on how that conflict is being conducted. I think if we look at, for example, where Congress exercised very strong oversight powers in the Iraq War, I think it was in the 2007 period when the Bush administration was considering and initiating a surge in forces and got very, very intense scrutiny from Congress about that policy. I'd like to see a lot more attention by Congress to how the wars are being conducted, how campaigns are being conducted, rather than just the focused attention of a lot of, I think, reform movements today, which are about how wars start.
Professor Hathaway, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think I basically agree with Matt. I would put it a little bit differently, though. I would say when we are starting a war, we should be asking, what is the result that we're hoping to achieve here? What is the end game, and how are we going to get there? We're often thinking about addressing an immediate threat, and you know, using military force to do that. But then, what comes next? You know, so if you just take the Libya intervention, which you mentioned, the U.S. joined a NATO-led intervention in Libya to address the threat posed by Gaddafi to his own people. But then, when that was successfully dealt with, Gaddafi was out of power. What's next? And no one had given sufficient thought to that. And as a result, right now, Libya is really overrun by warlords, and there is no stable government in place. And the problem we're facing in Afghanistan is something similar. The worry is that if American troops withdraw, the Afghan government just is not powerful enough, not stable enough to be able to maintain security for the people there. And so as soon as we withdraw, the whole thing is going to collapse, the same problem we're seeing in Iraq. So we're very good at destroying things. We're not very good at creating a stable situation that allows us to leave and leave the country in a better shape than it was when we first intervened.
You know, I'm mindful of the fact that we've been spending a lot of time focusing on these authorization of the use of military force. But underlying that is where we started, the War Powers Resolution, right? I mean, in sort of reacquainting myself with the text of that act from, again, like a half century ago, I think part of the problem is in its actual simplicity, right? I mean, for example, I'll just note that it just says hostilities I'm not even sure in 2021 how we would define that. Or perhaps maybe that's just the door through which presidents have been able to open things wide open because they can define hostilities however we want. So, Professor Hathaway, let me just ask you, if we're taking a look at the underlying act here, what would you change about it?
Well, you've put your finger on what I think is one of the central weaknesses of the War Powers Resolution. So it hinges so many of the triggers in the resolution on this term hostilities, and then it never defines the term. And that's just been a huge problem because it has allowed successive administrations to sort of invent new and different interpretations of the term, including, for instance, to say that the U.S. intervention in Libya was not, quote unquote, hostilities and therefore not governed by the War Powers Resolution, so that the president, despite the fact that we were engaging in a massive bombing campaign in the country that led to the end of the existing regime, that was not hostilities, and the president did not have to get authorization from Congress to continue those operations past 60 days. So it's a huge weakness in the law. And if you did nothing else and all you did was define that term in a clear way, that would be a really big step in the right direction.
Matthew Waxman, do you think that the War Powers Act itself is in need of reform, rewriting?
I'm not convinced of that. Like I said, I'd rather see Congress spending more of its attention scrutinizing whether means and ends are well aligned, whether planning assumptions are well tested. And when it comes to legislative reform of the War Powers Resolution, I think it's very, very hard to get this right. And there are some real dangers to getting it wrong. I worry that right now we're at a moment when the United States risks going too far and pulling back from its international leadership, including the role that it plays in deterring threats and reassuring allies. I think overhauling the War Powers Resolution could contribute unintentionally, or both intentionally and unintentionally, to that retrenchment, and could have some unintended dangerous consequences. I think these are policy arguments more than legal arguments. I agree that with Una that there are ways in which the statute itself could be tweaked, but I'm skeptical of a major legislative overhaul.
But if I may, isn't it a matter of fact that unintended consequences are going to come along with any policymaking act? And why not actually reassess the appropriateness of a law that's 50 years old that has allowed for the United States, for presidents to deploy the military in all sorts of places, as I talked about, you know, Panama, Grenada, et cetera. Unintended consequences are going to happen, but that shouldn't stop a reassessment, should it?
No, I completely agree with you. And I think, though, that points to the need to have serious legislative oversight, mm-hmm. serious legislative involvement, not just in the question of whether we initiate a particular intervention here and there, but in our congressional involvement in our military posture globally. You know, wars rarely begin out of the blue. This means that Congress needs to focus more heavily on overall military strategy and how American military resources are wielded well in advance of a crisis, rather than treating the outbreak of a crisis as Congress's sudden moment for influence.
Well, Professor Hathaway, we've just got a minute left here. And I do take Matthew Waxman's point about Congress perhaps not being willing to use the tools already available to it. I heard Congressman McGovern earlier saying, you know, maybe we should start thinking about auto appropriations, turnoffs, et cetera. But again, in this last minute here, as we're thinking about the War Powers Act and perhaps, you know, rethinking it, isn't there something to the fact that Congress just doesn't want to take these votes? It doesn't actually want to reassert itself in the way that we've been discussing.
Yeah, it often has avoided taking these votes, and that's part of the reason we're in this fix. But as Congressman Cole put it earlier, you know, we should not be allowing members of Congress to avoid the tough votes. This is their job. This is what they're there for. And we should have a system that ensures that they will take the tough votes, because that's what's necessary in order for us to have clear guidance as to what U.S. military operations are aiming at and that have the American people behind them.
Well, we will keep our eye on this continuing discussion on Capitol Hill. And for now, let me say thank you to Professor Ona Hathaway, Professor of International Law at Yale. Thank you so much. And Matthew Waxman, Professor of Law at Columbia. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.